Welcome to Explorations in Music, a production of KALW in cooperation with San Francisco Performances, the Alexander String Quartet, and Dr. Robert Greenberg. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This season, a triangle for the ages. Today, Robert breaks down.
It was Carnival, Mardi Gras time in Dusseldorf. The streets were filled with music and costumed people. In his dressing gown, Schumann, stumbling and sobbing, ran through the crowded streets, finally arriving at the Rhine Bridge. He ran to the middle, the toll taker yelling at him to stop. Crowds of people on either side of the bridge pointed at him and watched as he climbed over the rail and threw himself in the freezing river.
Dr. Robert Greenberg holds a Ph.D. in music composition from the University of California at Berkeley, and since 1989 has been San Francisco Performance's music historian in residence. He has performed, taught, and lectured extensively in North America and Europe. The Alexander String Quartet is among the world's premier ensembles, maintaining a busy international touring and teaching schedule and recording for their own label, Foghorn Classics. Robert and Clara had deep and abiding love and had six children. But as the wedding vows state, it's for better and for worse. Now here's Dr. Robert Greenberg.
Let us begin. Maestri, please, some music. We're going to hear the fourth movement opening of Robert Schumann's String Quartet in A major, opus 41, number 3 of 1842. There's something wrong with Robert. Like any working couple, Robert and Clara Schumann had to work hard to balance their personal lives with their professional lives. Robert, in particular, had to get used to playing second fiddle to his world-famous wife. Oh, so you're Clara's husband. And what exactly do you do? Their challenges aside, Robert and Clara managed to muddle successfully through the first 3.5 years of their marriage. But then 1844 rolled around, and it became apparent that something was wrong, something was seriously wrong with the 34-year-old Robert Schumann. He began experiencing increasingly worrisome psychological and physical symptoms: depression, weakness, dizziness, impaired vision, incessant trembling. In October, during a stay in the city of Dresden, Clara wrote in her diary that, quote, "Robert did not sleep a single night. His imagination painted the most terrible pictures. In the early morning, I generally found him bathed in tears," unquote. A year later, in 1845, Schumann's doctor, Dr. Carl Helbig, described Schumann as being, quote, "depressed and physically debilitated, whose complaints ranged from insomnia, general weakness, auditory disturbances, tremors and chills, to a whole range of phobias, including fear of metal items such as keys and knives, fear of medicines, mountain heights, and tall buildings, unquote. And yet, amazingly, through it all, life went on. Children were born. There were six of them by 1849. And incredibly, Schumann continued to compose magnificent music. Hello, Dusseldorf. In the spring of 1850, Schumann's friend Ferdinand Hiller offered him a job that he, Hiller, was in the process of vacating, that of music director for the Rhineland city of Dusseldorf and conductor of the Dusseldorf Orchestra. Robert accepted the job, and the Schumann clan arrived there in September of 1850. Now, Schumann's gig there in Dusseldorf began so very well. When he first mounted the orchestra podium on October 24th of 1850, the orchestra gave him a triple fanfare. But within just two seasons, the orchestra was demanding his resignation. You see, not only was Schumann virtually the worst conductor to ever hoist a baton, but his deteriorating physical and mental health made it impossible for him to even fake it. The end of his career as a conductor occurred in October of 1853, when the Dusseldorf Orchestral Committee finally demanded his resignation. Now, this is where things start to reconnect for us. In September of 1853, just a few weeks before tendering his resignation, Schumann received a visit from a small, blonde, 20-year-old composer and pianist named Johannes Brahms. As you recall, Brahms played his compositions for Robert and Clara. They were utterly gobsmacked by both Brahms and the music. They invited him to stay with them for about a month, and indeed, it was the month of October, the same month during which Schumann tendered his resignation, that Brahms stayed with the Schumanns. In doing so, Brahms became Schumann's most devoted disciple. Schumann arranged for the publication of a number of Brahms' works and wrote that article, that widely read article, in which he praised Brahms as the Messiah of German music, that article that we've been referring to as The Curse. Brahms did indeed swallow hard when he read that article, but he was also filled with gratitude as well. He would remain a selfless friend to both Robert and Clara during the terrible, terrible time that was about to envelop them all. In February of 1854, roughly 4.5 months after meeting Brahms, Schumann's mind finally gave way. He was bipolar and, of course, by now firmly entrenched in tertiary syphilis. During the evening of February 10th, he was tormented by what he called, quote, very strong and painful aural disturbances. He was hearing things. 4 days later, on February 14th, 1854, he was sitting in a restaurant with the violinist Rupert Becker reading a newspaper. Schumann suddenly put down the paper and said, I can't read anymore. I keep hearing the note A. Within a couple of days, the sounds in Schumann's ears had taken shape. He reported hearing, and again we quote Schumann, magnificent music with instruments of splendid resonance, the like of which has never been heard on earth before. Well, needless to say, Clara became more and more frightened. She wrote in her diary, my poor Robert suffers terribly. All sounds are transformed for him into music. He has said several times that if it does not stop, he'll go out of his mind, unquote. During the night of February 17th, Schumann got out of bed and wrote down a melody in E-flat major, a melody that he said the angels had sung to him. Thank you. The next day, February 18th, as if in some terrible horror movie, the angels in his head turned into devils that took the form of tigers and hyenas. Again, Clara wrote in her diary, "He became hysterical. He cried out in agony, and the two doctors, who luckily were here at the time, could hardly hold him down. I shall never forget the way he looked at me. After about half an hour, he calmed down, and the doctors finally got him into bed." The following day, Sunday, February 19th, was just as bad. Schumann claimed to be surrounded by evil spirits, which he called those superterrestrial and subterranean men. Over the course of the next week, Schumann kept repeating obsessively that he was a criminal and that he was going to go to hell. Finally, on February 26th, he asked to be taken to a lunatic asylum. He was terrified that he might physically injure Clara or the children. Clara and Robert's doctor, Dr. Boger, convinced him to go to bed. When he woke up on the 27th, he murmured to Clara, "I am not worthy of your love." The dreadful climax was at hand. Monday, February 27th, 1854, was a cold and rainy day in Dusseldorf. Clara, who'd been keeping watch over Robert for days, asked her elder daughter, Marie, who was then just 13 years old — this is the same Marie who had greeted Brahms at the door the previous October — Clara asked Marie to watch Papa while she, Clara, talked with the doctor. Marie walked into her father's room. He was standing in the middle of the floor, pale as death, and wearing only a dressing gown, a bathrobe. When he saw his daughter, he covered his face with his hands and shrieked, "Oh, God," and then ran out of the room and out of the house, barefoot, into the midwinter streets, heading for the Rhine River. It was Carnival, Mardi Gras time in Dusseldorf. The streets were filled with music and costumed people. In his dressing gown, Schumann, stumbling and sobbing, ran through the crowded streets, finally arriving at the Rhine Bridge. You know, a filmmaker could not have come up with a scene any worse than this one. Having arrived at the bridge, he ran to the middle, the toll taker yelling at him to stop. One hopes it was a humane yell and not, "You didn't pay the toll." Crowds of people on either side of the bridge pointed at him and watched as he climbed over the rail and threw himself in the freezing river. A small fishing boat rushed over and pulled the struggling Schumann out of the water. When they got him ashore, someone in the crowd recognized him. It is Herr Music Director Schumann. Schumann's frantic daughter Marie, who had been looking for her father, saw a crowd approaching on the street. In the middle was the dripping, half-frozen Robert with his hands over his face. That was the last time that Marie, or any of her brothers or sisters, ever saw Robert Schumann again. Clara, herself on the edge of a nervous breakdown, had to be physically restrained in order to keep her from seeing her husband. For reasons that we will find impossible to fathom, she was never informed of his suicide attempt. It was something she only learned 4.5 years later, 2 years after his death. Schumann's doctors, fearing that the sight of his wife would agitate their patient, forbade Clara from saying goodbye to him. He was hustled off to a private sanitarium in Endenich, a suburb of Bonn. As for Clara, in her own words, "I sat in a stupor thinking, now I'm done for." She would not see her husband for 2.5 years when he lay on his deathbed. Now, this is a terrible story, and frankly, it's not even close to being over. But for now, let's step back 12 years to better times, to 1842, to Schumann's so-called year of chamber music, the year during which his manic creative muse enabled him to churn out the great bulk of his chamber music, including his 3 string quartets, in just 9 months. Schumann's string quartet in A major, opus 41, number 3 of 1842. The A major is Schumann's most popular and by far most idiosyncratic string quartet. Our approach to the quartet will be to focus on a few of its idiosyncrasies, particularly in regard to Schumann's approach to musical form. Movement one, sonata form. Now please, by necessity, a quick reminder. Sonata form is a musical structure in which typically two contrasting themes are introduced in a section we now call the exposition. Those themes, and indeed the transitional material between them, are then developed in a section called the development section. In the third large section of a sonata form movement, the recapitulation, the themes return in their original order, but with some harmonic differences. And finally, a tail section towards called a coda brings such a movement to its conclusion. All right, let's begin by hearing the themes, and then we'll talk about the formal idiosyncrasies. Theme one begins with a sighing descent of an interval, a distance, a melodic space called a perfect fifth. Zach, please play that again. That falling interval of a perfect fifth, which is also a prominent feature of theme two, has been called the Clara motive because it would seem to describe with a sigh the name Clara. That's why I'm not going to quit my day gig, okay? The word Clara followed by an involuntary tremor of the heart. Let's hear theme one in its entirety, along with the 7-measure introduction that precedes the theme. Here's the opening of Schumann's second theme, a theme that also features, as we've observed, this falling perfect fifth. So here's the structural idiosyncrasy that annihilates our perception of this movement as being a typical sonata form movement. The development section that follows the introduction of these themes features almost exclusively falling clara motives of various sorts, after which it comes to a pause. And then, it feels as if the development section just ended, but the next thing we hear is theme two. ¶¶ as educated listeners, we're wondering, hey, what happened to the beginning of the recapitulation, the expected return of theme one? Well, we heard it, but because it was so brief and because it was harmonized differently than it originally was in the exposition, we perceived it as being part of the development section. The result is Schumann has conflated, he's interwoven, he's elided the development section with the recapitulation to, I think, stunning effect. By eliding the development section and recapitulation, Schumann eliminates what would have been expected structural markers that his audience would have expected to hear. And thus, the second half of this movement appears to follow a path of its own making. That's really cool. Movement two, theme and variations form. Well, talk about a structurally idiosyncratic movement. Yes, on the surface, this second movement would seem to be a straightforward theme with four variations, concluding with a closing section called coda. Here's the opening of the theme, an elegant old-style saraband that's a three-step Baroque-era dance set in the key of F-sharp minor. The first variation, marked assai agitato, which means agitated enough, sees this theme manipulated in such a way that events begin on the third rather than the first beat of its measures. Listen. Variation 2 does away with the rhythmic hesitancy of Variation 1 and steams full speed ahead. The rhythmic energy and the momentum continue to build as we hear the third variation, a contrapuntal tour de force. Finally, as befits its position as the final variation, Variation 4 is the most dramatic in the group. A coda follows this fourth variation, bringing the movement to its conclusion in the key of F sharp major. So, seems pretty straight ahead, right? A theme with four variations. What is the formal idiosyncrasy of this movement? Well, Schumann begins the movement not with the theme, but rather he begins the movement with the first variation. After which, we then hear variations 2 and three. And only then, after having heard three variations, do we actually hear the theme itself, which is then followed by the fourth variation and the coda. You know, it's like telling the punchline of a joke first, which, by the way, is a certain technique my family was very good at. Alvin, tell the joke. What joke? You know, the joke, the one that ends this way. Natalie, you just gave away the end of the joke. That was part of my parents. We used to call it the Alvin and Natalie show, yes. But it's like telling the punchline before you've heard the joke, or it's like watching some Quentin Tarantino movie in which the storyline is non-linear. It is a fascinating and effective idea, an idea that, of course, can only be done once in a career. Movement three, Adagio. Well, this ardent, rhapsodic, freely developing third movement lacks any particular structural idiosyncrasy. However, knowing who wrote it and when he wrote it, the year after his marriage, it is impossible not to assume that this adagio is anything but another of Schumann's impassioned love songs to his Clara. And we will hear this third movement in the upcoming performance. Movement four. Well, when it comes to idiosyncratic formal structure, this fourth movement is the funkiest of them all, funkier than anything else in Schumann's Opus 41 quartets. The movement is primarily structured as a rondo, sort of. A rondo is a movement in which a principal theme, a rondo theme, returns periodically after various contrasting episodes. The rondo theme is, in effect, a refrain. Here, then, is Schumann's rondo theme, his refrain, which will come back periodically. It's a bouncing, ants-in-your-pants-styled theme of Haydn-like brevity. It's only 14 measures long and great memorability. Now, I said this movement was a rondo, sort of. My prevarication was due to the number of contrasting episodes Schumann presents us with over the course of the movement. You see, your basic garden variety rondo introduces two contrasting episodes, creating a large-scale structure of A, rondo theme, B, first contrasting episode, A, rondo theme, C, second contrasting episode, back to the rondo theme, and then a coda to bring this process of contrast and return to its conclusion. In an extended rondo, the kind that Beethoven, for example, employed in each of the third movements of his five piano concerti, the B section is repeated, creating a large-scale form of A, B, A, C, A, B, A. And that's about as long as a rondo gets, seven parts plus a coda. Well, Schumann goes a little crazy here. In his rondo, we hear 13 parts plus a coda. A, B, A, C, A, D, A, B, A, C, A, D, A plus coda. I would also point out that the restatements of Schumann's rondo theme are in different keys and are of different lengths, a practice much more akin to something called ritornello form, a Baroque-era construct brought to its point of highest development by Antonio Vivaldi and Sebastian Bach. So, we could just as easily call this movement a ritornello form, sort of. But then there are those D sections, the longest passages in the movement. The first D section runs 62 measures in length. The rondo theme at its first appearance runs 14 measures in length. At its first appearance, the D section is marked quasi-trio, a trio being the middle section of a minuet and trio form movement or a scherzo. Here's the D section on its first appearance without its internal repetition. Thank you. So with its two appearances, with the two appearances of this quasi-trio, is this movement actually a double minuet or a double scherzo? No, it's not a minuet or a scherzo. Then what the hell is it, please? Help us. It's the fourth movement of Schumann's String Quartet in A Major, Opus 41, number 3. And it's a kaleidoscope of themes and moods and textures, and it is great fun. The Alexander String Quartet performs Robert Schumann's String Quartet in A Major, Opus 41, number 3 of 1842. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Explorations in Music on KALW. Today's program featured Robert Schumann's Quartet in A Major, Opus 41, No. 3. Tune in next time when we hear Brahms' String Quartet No. 2 in A Minor. Explorations in Music is produced for KALW by Eric Wayne in association with San Francisco Performances, the Alexander String Quartet, and Dr. Robert Greenberg. For more information about San Francisco Performances and their upcoming events, visit them on the web at sfperformances.org. The Alexander String Quartet are violinists Zacharias Grafilo and Frederick Lifsitz, violist Paul Yarbrough, and cellist Sandy Wilson. You can find out more and purchase recordings of the ASQ on their website, asq4.com. The lecturer was Dr. Robert Greenberg, music historian in residence at San Francisco Performances. The concerts were recorded at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco. You can join us on Facebook by searching for Explorations in Music. Our email address is explorations@kalw.org. Thanks for listening. I'm David LaTulipe.